This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore.
Coming up on the one-year mark of the podcast.
That's true, eh?
Yeah, we've got some really great guests lined up that we're going to be meeting this summer. So I think we've got guests all the way through Labor Day. So that's really cool. And that gave some momentum, and people are seeing it online. We're able to get introductions to some pretty cool people. So that's kind of fun.
It's absolutely true. And I think I say this too much. Maybe I don't. I don't know. Maybe I don't say it enough. But we definitely appreciate everyone that's listening and everyone that's sending us. I mean, I've said this before, but I'm getting at least a couple of emails a week from people saying, you know, I heard you say this. What do you mean by that? Or have you thought about talking about this in the podcast? And it's really engaging for us.
And even when you meet someone new, like, well, I get your investment philosophy. I've been listening to the podcast or watching the videos.
Oh, that happens all the time now. Yeah.
So they kind of know us, I think, and they've accepted and bought into the philosophy. So this week was our episode with our format of a couple of current topics, a couple of interesting stories we found.
Yeah, it was a good episode. Not a whole lot to say about it. We'll obviously get into the episode in a second.
All right. Listen. There you go.
Welcome to episode 46 of the Rational Reminder Podcast. So we're still following our old new format.
Yeah, I think it's working well. We're getting good topics, good ideas. Certainly no shortage of content.
So for the first current topic we had for this week, someone sent me this article from the Wall Street Journal talking about the Sohn Investment Conference. If anybody doesn't know about it, it's a fundraising conference where they bring in, it's supposed to be like the best people on Wall Street, and they bring in like the people that come in to speak are, they're serious people.
But they've raised some serious money too.
Oh yeah, and it's a great cause. It goes for childhood cancer research.
They've raised $85 million over the past 20 years. This is a big deal on Wall Street. And it's also co-sponsored. I found a YouTube video on it, co-sponsored by CNBC.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal with big names that come out.
And the hook is that you're getting access to like hedge fund or proprietary investment managers who would not normally disclose their investing ideas to the public. And you're getting to hear them speak about their best investing ideas at that time.
Which for them, I'm sure, is very entertaining to go and listen to this. And potentially a good money maker for us to go would also be very entertaining. I mean, can you imagine going to see this thing? It'd be hilarious.
It would be cool.
It'd be very cool.
Genuinely. Like, even though we think that type of investing is not the smartest thing in the world, these people are still brilliant. However you want to slice it, they're smart people.
Yeah.
And the tickets, like for us to go as financial professionals, $5,000 US.
Right.
Anyway, so Wall Street Journal last year, they took the stock picks of all of these people. So you've got these hedge fund managers going up on stage and talking about their best stock picks, long or short.
It was like, what, 12, 13 people?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
So Wall Street Journal recorded all of their picks, and both long and short. And then they went back to their offices, I guess, and opened up a newspaper, pinned it to the wall, and literally threw darts at stocks.
At the stock pages.
In the stock pages of the newspaper. And so for the 2019 conference, Wall Street Journal came out with an article talking about that experiment. And the stock picks of the dart throwing smoked the, you know, professional stock pickers.
Which oddly enough, and I've heard this example before, going back to a little bit of science, that's what you would expect, wouldn't you? Because there's more small cap stocks in the pages of the paper. So you'd expect it to outperform anyways.
I guess so.
From a purely theoretical standpoint.
If you did
standpoint.
Maybe 10,000 of those trials, right. Maybe. But in this one, I think it's just luck.
Pure random luck.
Yeah. But it's still interesting. And it was like, it was 30% outperformance by the dart throwing over that 1 year period.
Did you see the guy that won?
No.
I saw an interview with him. So young guy, he's a manager. It's Andrew Wilkin of, I think it's called Rangeley Capital.
Okay.
So he picked, he was on CNBC explaining his pick and had a whole story around why La Quinta, which is the hotel chain, was such a good choice. And he's the guy that won the contest.
They had Jeffrey Gundlach, who is a name that I knew from Double Line Capital. His recommendation for last year was short Facebook and long Spider S&P. Oil and gas ETF.
Didn't work out.
He got smoked on both sides. It's entertainment at the end of the day, I guess.
It's entertainment. It's a great cause. It's what these people do. So you have to give them credit for taking what they believe in and raising a lot of cash for something that, you know, pediatric cancer is.
But on the other side of the coin, it is fascinating to see who should be the best. Like, if anyone's going to be good at doing this, it's going to be these guys. It's not going to be me.
No.
It's not going to be you.
I wouldn't be standing by for your invitation.
If anybody's going to be good at that, it's going to be these guys. And in this sample anyway, they sure fell short.
Yeah.
Which is what you'd expect.
So the other current story is one that we have talked about forever.
Very much related to what we just talked about.
Absolutely. So I remember back when we did the radio show Business at Night, we used to talk about the SPIVA reports. That's the Standard & Poor's Index versus Active Scorecard. And once again, it's absolutely no surprise. They measure how well did active money managers do versus the index. And as you just said earlier, once again, they got smoked. I mean, the story never changes.
I think it's the same every year. It is the same every year, but I think it's particularly interesting to look at this data in a year where the market was particularly bad.
Yeah, all you had to do was make a proper choice in the fall of last year, and you would have avoided the last six weeks of the year, right?
Like that's, I mean, it's part of the pitch anyway. An active manager's say they're not necessarily saying I'm going to knock it out of the park every year, but they're definitely saying, or at least a lot of them are definitely saying, when markets are bad, we'll protect the downside. That's a huge part of the active pitch.
Yep. And we've heard it from a few people we met this week.
Yeah.
But the main line of the story that I read out of it, they took an overall look at all the different asset classes, and 75% of Canadian funds overall underperform their representative index. So from all the different asset classes. So the common pushback, of course, is index funds also underperform the index.
Right. 100% of index funds are going to underperform.
Right. You have no chance of beating it, which is mathematical. And you mustn't forget either. You can't get the full index return because there's always some expense ratio in there, but you can get pretty close. And replication now is so good.
That's the thing that my favorite counter argument to what you just said, which is something that we hear relatively often. The counter to that is sure, but index funds underperform by their tiny, tiny little fee and maybe by some withholding tax, depending on the asset class that we're talking about. But active funds are massively underperforming, at least on average. It's not like they're just underperforming by a little bit. In a lot of cases, they're underperforming on average by even more than their fees.
But of course, you know, advisors are not finding the below average funds.
Stop. Stop it.
Just a little baiting going on.
But I looked at the data on that too. The SPIVA report had the asset weighted performance of Canadian funds against the benchmark index. So that's weighted by the magnitude of assets in each fund. So the biggest fund has the most influence. Where the money is, right, which is what really matters. So the average asset weighted return for Canadian equity mutual funds in 2018, so just for the calendar year, was negative 10.06%. Well, the Canadian index, S&P TSX Composite, was down 8.89%.
Now, I didn't dig into the details, but do they look at all funds are they kind of blind to the expense ratios?
They don't actually disclose. It's not anywhere in the SPIVA report, but I emailed the guy that prepares it a couple of years ago, and he said that they mostly use A-class funds.
So there is advisor comp in there.
Yeah.
So they underperform by, 1.15%, considering there's probably a point of advisor compensation in there, 1% of advisor compensation, you know, asset weighted, they're basically doing the index.
Hey, not bad.
If not a little bit, they're basically doing the index because there's advisor compensation plus a manager compensation. So they pretty much are doing the market, which is pretty much what you'd expect in aggregate.
Maybe they did add some value that year, just not so much after costs.
Right. So you can make the case it's not really fair to have the index funds not have advisor compensation in it.
Okay, but let's keep going. Small cap Canadian equity funds were down 16.39%, while the TSX completion index was down 12.85%. Story falls apart in that asset class.
But I thought the small caps is where managers can add value because they can be more nimble.
There's
greater disparity.
The small cap market is supposed to be, as the story goes, less efficient because there are less people looking at it, which is supposed to be a reason that active managers can add value there. We sure didn't see that last year.
Didn't they get smoked on U.S. equity too?
Oh, yeah. So U.S. equity in Canadian dollars, returns for the S&P 500 were 1.83, or sorry, asset-weighted U.S. equity funds in Canada were plus 1.83% last year, while the S&P 500 was plus 4.23.
But don't forget, I mean, once again, young you, based on what the trolls are saying, you're looking at evidence and science and should just be looking at sporadic one-off evidence of people earn returns.
Yeah. Someone wrote...
You've had crazy stuff trolled to you this week.
Someone wrote a response to my Globe Mail article, which I don't even want to talk about most of it. It was something. But one of the points that he made was that he was actually... he tweeted at me saying, I'm going to respond to your Globe Mail article. And I said, okay, but that was just kind of scratching the surface. Here's a link to my YouTube video. Respond to that if you want to respond to anything, because I went into way more detail there. So he did. But he says in the video, when I start talking about factors, which, by the way, are the foundation of our understanding of financial markets, when I started talking
about- The understanding, not just our. I mean, this is-
Yeah. This is it. Not us. Yeah. So his comment was that when I started talking about factors, it made him think of his daughter who's in elementary school. And the factors were kind of like her getting good grades, but successful dividend investors were kind of like her actually understanding the material that she was learning. Yes, I also made that face.
Okay. I don't understand, but it's...
Well, it's just basically just saying that we're being too academic, but academia is not reality.
Those that can't teach and those that can do. I guess that's a
similar kind of story, I guess.
The argument.
Yeah.
Anyways, these reports come out every year. They have forever. It's never the different story ever. I don't think I've ever seen a story on the Spiva report be different.
The other piece of data that's in there, though, that's pretty interesting is the survivorship. So they've reported on 10-year survivorship for Canadian funds. And you look across all the different asset categories, and it's roughly 50%.
But you would think that the survivorship would be going up because so many funds have been killed off. And with
New funds, though.
Are they? I guess they are. But I would think with the marching of assets away from active towards passive across the world, maybe less so in Canada, you would think that that survivorship number would be going up, but it never seems to go up.
There are a lot of funds. And I mean, you think about it's not that people are migrating toward indexing. I think the general investing philosophies are shifting, which means fund managers are making factor products and they're making quantitative products as opposed to traditionally actively managed products.
The mix of products is shifting perhaps.
Right. But you're still getting new active products all the time. And then the other piece of that is if we say, okay, this 50% of funds survived over the last 10 years, and those funds may have been successful because the manager was skilled, but it may have been because he was lucky or she was lucky. And we know from the research that they were much more likely to have been lucky than skilled. So you wouldn't expect those 50% that survived over the last 10 years to survive the next 10 years.
Right.
You'd actually expect a lot of them, maybe 50% of them, to also collapse just because they were lucky and that's why they got successful. And now maybe they'll get unlucky. Anyway, so Spiva report comes out twice a year, like you said.
Yep.
But it's always interesting. And like I said, when we started talking about this segment, it's particularly interesting in years where the market is down because that's where active managers are supposed to shine.
Right.
And as we can see from the data in this year's report, you were no better off in active funds than you were just being in the index.
Right.
So that argument falls apart. Standard & Poor's actually did an article on Seeking Alpha when they released their report, and they talked about the points that we made and a couple others too. But they talked about this data busts the myth on active beating passive in down markets, and it busts the myth on active managers adding value in small caps because Canadian small cap funds did terribly.
Yeah, we have a guest coming up in a few weeks, we hope, with someone from Standard & Poor's. That'll be a great interview.
Yeah, that will be.
So low vol stocks, you're getting questions about low vol stocks? This is our portfolio topic this week.
I've been getting questions about low volatility for a while.
What a great name. Like, who doesn't want low volatility? So I looked up, what is a low vol stock? Get this. This is on Google. I just did it. So volatility is a variation in price, and low means variation is lower.
It adds up.
But that's appealing.
That approximately makes sense. I'm joking. That's exactly what it is, obviously.
Of course it is.
Yeah. So on the YouTube channel, a lot of people ask just in the comments, like, can you do a video on low volatility stocks? Or they'll even ask more involved questions like, okay, but you just said that market beta explains 2/3 of returns. How can that be true if lower beta stocks tend to have better returns? It's a valid question.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wrote a YouTube video on that topic. So I thought it'd be good to talk about just because we have all the data from that.
And it's being marketed. So there's a lot of fun brand names coming out now with low vol portfolios.
So I think the biggest selling point for low volatility stocks, and the low, like you kind of explained it, but a low volatility means market beta. That's like the risk of the market. If an index fund, for example, like a US total market index fund would have a market beta of 1, well, it is the market. So if the market goes up 10%, that portfolio goes up 10%. A low beta portfolio is a portfolio with less sensitivity to the market. So if the market goes up 10%, a portfolio with a beta of 0.5 might go up, well, it would go up 5%. You'd expect it to go up 5%. So that's low beta, lower volatility than the market. But over the last 50 years, low beta stocks have been anomalous. They've had higher returns than you would expect based on the amount of their market sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. So market inefficiency.
It appears to be the market is not pricing in some type of risk, or it's not accurately pricing those types of assets, because you would expect a riskier asset to have higher return. That's how the market is supposed to price assets in an efficient market. Thinking about it through market beta, it's very clearly an anomaly. Low beta stocks, they definitely have higher returns than they should based on their market betas.
So listeners of the podcast know that we talked about the factors. So I'm sure many people are thinking, okay, factors must explain part of this. Like, what's going on here? Like, hopefully that's a normal reaction now that people are kind of getting the philosophy.
So that's
not a free lunch.
And you can kind of backpedal, I think. And you can kind of backpedal and think about small cap and value stocks, which we've talked about a fair amount on the podcast. But you go back pre-1992, or maybe even a little bit earlier than that, but pre sort of Fama French three-factor model. Mm-hmm. If you looked at small cap stocks, for example, through the capital asset pricing model, so just through market beta, small cap stocks have higher average returns than would be expected by their market beta.
Right.
So market goes up X amount, small cap stocks co-vary with the market by a certain amount, but they have higher returns than you would expect based on that covariation with the market. So it appears through the single factor model, through the capital asset pricing model, it appears that you're getting higher returns without any additional risk.
There has to be a but coming.
Well, that seems like an anomaly, right? And then the same thing was found for value stocks. So at the time, this was like disproving efficient markets. It was saying, okay, capital asset pricing model is the model we have to relate risk and expected returns, and it's not able to accurately price these types of assets.
Right.
It's not able to predict the expected returns of these assets. Anyway, so over time, papers come out about small cap and value, and then Fama and French wrap it up in 1992, saying the reason that their average returns are higher is not because they're magical. It's because small cap is an independent risk.
Right.
Value is an independent risk.
Yep.
So now if you run the three-factor model on small cap and value stocks, there's no longer a higher average return than you'd expect based on the risk taken. It's just they're taking more risk. They're taking market risk, small size risk, and value risk, or they've got a exposure to those factors is another way to say
it. Okay, so let's bring this into low vol stocks.
So this is where it gets interesting, is that you take a three-factor model and look at low volatility stocks through that lens, and even based on their market betas, size exposure, and value exposure, they still have higher average returns than you'd expect.
And this is where your hero stepped in and gives you an answer.
Who's the hero? Fama and French?
No, Dr. Robert Novy Marks.
Right. Well, Fama and French and Novy Marks all kind of solved this. In 2013 was when Fama and French came out with their second big factor model paper, where they kind of said, okay, in 1992, market size and value, those are the factors that we understood to explain differences in returns. And then in the 2013 model added two new factors. So they said profitability and investment
Yep.
are like quantitative characteristics of stocks that we can use to explain differences in returns. And when you apply that factor model, you can explain low volatility. So basically what it ends up being is that low volatility stocks are stocks with low betas, but they're also value stocks and they're stocks with robust profitability. And through the five-factor model, there are stocks that also invest conservatively. So there we go. Market's efficient again. It's explained through exposure to known factors. So low volatility is no longer an anomaly.
So is low volatility basically just a rebranding of the factors?
This is the problem. Sort of. Sometimes. This is the challenge. So if you look at low volatility stocks, most of the time, they're going to be value stocks. And they're going to be stocks with robust profitability most of the time. I have the data point.
But it's also what you're excluding too, isn't it? Because we talked about that a few weeks ago. Like small cap works because of what you're leaving out of the portfolio.
Yeah. So Novy Marks in 2016 did a paper on this as well. And he showed with his research that the tilt toward low volatility stocks is beneficial mostly because it excludes small cap growth stocks with weak profitability, which we know to be, you know, not good stocks in general. So he's saying that yeah, low vol has looked good in the past, but it's looked good more so because you're excluding small cap growth with weak profitability than because you're focusing on the low volatility stocks. So his point in his paper, Novy Marks's point, is that because the benefits of low volatility are mostly coming from excluding small cap growth with weak profitability, it would be far more efficient to just take a market index and exclude those stocks, as opposed to building a relatively concentrated portfolio with relatively high turnover around this small subset of low volatility stocks. Does that make sense? Do you need to back it up for our listeners? Because
I think we're good. It's all about engineering the portfolios based on these known factors of what should be in and what should not be in.
So I looked at USMV, which is the largest, I believe, low volatility ETF. It's a US listed ETF.
It's like $25 billion portfolio.
It's a big fund. So it's got 213 holdings compared to, if you look at ITOT, which is like total market US index ETF, it's got 3,552 holdings. So you start thinking about that. You've got to get access to low vol, you're taking this massively concentrated portfolio, which is probably going to have...
Well, it's still 213 holdings. I mean, we've seen people come in lately with high conviction portfolios of 15 stocks.
Sure. It's more diversified than that. But the more holdings that you have, the more diversified that you are, the tighter your dispersion of returns comes.
That's right.
So with the 213 holdings, you might be getting some access to low volatility, which is really just value and profitability, or that's where the benefit's coming from anyway. But you're also getting this relatively concentrated portfolio. The other metric that I looked at for USMV was turnover. So because
this was a big number.
Yeah. And it's you get the same kind of thing with a small cap value fund like IJS, 25% turnover compared to 10% for ITOT, which is also kind of high, I thought. But anyway, so what you'd expect though, and what Novi Marks is saying in his paper, is that if you target low volatility specifically, you're going to get a concentrated portfolio with relatively high turnover. So he says it's an inefficient portfolio. And because the benefit's coming from excluding the small cap growth with weak profitability, you're better off just starting with the market and excluding those types of stocks as opposed to targeting the low volatility. But it gets even more interesting, in my opinion, anyway. So there's a 212.
People asked for this. Remember that. We had requests for this topic.
On the YouTube channel, to be fair, maybe the podcast listeners are going to hate it. So there's a 2012 paper by someone named Pim Van Fleet, and they found that while it's true that on average low volatility strategies do have value exposure, which is where a lot of the benefit comes from, historically, low volatility has been in a value regime only 62% of the time. So on average over the long term, sure, you're getting value exposure, but only in 62% of historical time periods.
It's not persistent exposure to the value, which is what you'd want.
If you're targeting value exposure.
The Fama-French factors.
Right. So if you're following low volatility, you're not getting consistent exposure to the factors. Right. And if you believe that the factors are what explain differences in returns,
believing evidence
and believing in market efficiency, then you want consistent exposure to the factors, not inconsistent.
That's really interesting.
And then it gets even more interesting because they looked at the performance of low volatility when it's in a value regime versus when it's in a growth regime. And they found that on average, low volatility stocks have outperformed the market by 2% when they're in a value regime, and they've underperformed by 1.4% when they're in a growth regime, which is what you'd expect, just based on the factor exposures. Anyway, so the point is it was an anomaly up until 2013 when the five-factor model came out. And Fama and French, they did a paper specifically addressing, like looking at anomalies with the five-factor model, and they specifically addressed low volatility and showed that the addition of the profitability and investment factors explains it.
So I think the big take home is don't be swayed by marketing and branding and labeling of these products.
Yeah.
Like the factors, it's science. Understand the science and you can just forget about all this kind of stuff.
And I looked at ITOT too, and it's like, yeah, you want to exclude small cap growth with weak profitability, but small cap growth is 2% of ITOT. So are you better off with total market with that little bit of small cap growth, which you don't really want, but it's not that much in the portfolio.
I swing it anyways.
Or are you better off with this relatively highly concentrated portfolio with higher turnover and higher fees and all that kind of stuff?
So on to the planning subject?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I'd finish off by saying that I would not add low volatility to a portfolio because you're getting inconsistent factor exposure.
Get the factors you want. And if I want water, I'll ask for water.
And even like if we look at IGS, which is small cap value, it's at least got consistent exposure to the size premium, the value premium, and the profitability premium. Consistent, like through since inception. Whereas with low volatility, you're getting this time varying factor exposure. So you don't really know what you're getting, I guess, is the challenge. On to the next.
On to the planning. So I think this is a a good item. I did some extra research on it. So Financial FP Canada, which is the formerly Financial Planning Standards Council, came out with their assumptions that planners should use in building their financial plans.
Guidelines, they called them.
Guidelines, they're called. And they help you with what inflation rate you should use and the rates of return expectations for different asset classes. And it's interesting how these are in line with what, I mean, my first observation is they're in line with what we use in our planning.
Now, to be fair, we participated in building the, like, PWL Capital.
Yeah, they gave us a shout out in there too, a thanks.
Well, they did a survey.
Yeah.
And we were one of the companies. And we responded to the survey with our expected return assumptions. And they did 25% weight toward those survey results in developing their expected return assumptions.
Yeah, I thought it was cool how they weighted they gave an equal weighted average of estimates from, you know, CPP and the Quebec Pension Plan Actuarial Report and a survey of the professionals, like you mentioned, and then some historical data. So I thought it seems like a reasonable way of coming up with numbers, and they come out pretty close to ours, which is maybe weighted a bit differently, but they're all in that zone of, you know, for equities between, you know, low 6% and low 7% per year.
The really important, now I got to also say that I don't agree with you. It's interesting the way that they develop their assumptions. I don't think it's, well, I don't want to say it's not smart. It's not how I would have, well, it's not how we do it.
No, but you get to a reasonable, because the point being, I think, is that so many people use much higher numbers.
Yep.
For example, I looked up, wonder what Dave Ramsey, our good friend Dave Ramsey uses, the massive podcast.
12% or something.
12%. So I went to his website and said,
Is that it? 12%?
Here's a quote. It's not difficult to find several mutual funds that average or exceed 12% long-term growth, even in today's market. And then he goes down below and says the market has earned, I think he says 11.97, average return has been 11.97% for the past, since 1923. I'm like, that sounds high. So I go to our data set that we have here and I look it up and it's actually closer to 10. I'm like, where's the 2% spread? His number is not compounded. It's the average annual return, not the compound return. So I think you actually eat the compound return, right? Not the average return?
Yeah, I would say that is
true. So that's a 200 basis point spread right there. And obvious next question, where are fees in this?
But you know what? He's not wrong. I could go find you a whole bunch of mutual funds that have returned 12% over the last 10 years. I couldn't find the ones that are going to return 12%.
Oh, yeah.
But I could find the ones that have.
That have, for sure. I mean, Jack Bogle came out a few years ago and said it's safer to assume something in the 6% range.
Yeah. And I think that I don't know where people get these numbers, but I'll often talk to people who have maybe used like an online calculator that they found that had a default rate of return in there. And it'll often be 7 or 8%, which is, yeah, like I would say that's probably high. But I think what I was going to say about the way that FP Canada arrived at these figures, they weighted other people's expectations, which I thought was just, it's a little strange. I mean, sure, I'm happy with the way that we arrive at our expectations. I'm sure that CPP also does a good job. I'm sure that QPP also does a good job. But there is an evidence-based way to develop expected return assumptions. The evidence shows that the most reliable way to estimate future returns is based on current price earnings. That is the single most accurate way. Like Buckingham, Larry Swedro's firm, that's all they use. They use the current implied rate of return based on the price earnings at that time. Now, we don't do it that way. And the reason that we do it that way, but we weight it. So we do 50% current implied rate of return based on price earnings. And the reason that's important is because when prices are high, your expected future return is lower, which is what the data show. The data show that if prices are, well, what I said.
And we've talked about that many times.
Right. So what we do, though, which is different from what Larry Swedro's firm Buckingham does, they just use that implied rate of return from the price earnings, I think.
And are they putting in the premiums at all in their return expectations?
They do, yeah. Buckingham does 1/3 of the past premiums.
So we don't include any premiums in ours. We're broad market on the assumptions.
Yeah, which is a conservative, well, should be a conservative assumption. So anyway, we do 50% the current implied rate of return and 50% 50-year historical average. And the reason that we do that, even though that's not necessarily the evidence-based way to do expected returns, the reason that we do that is it decreases the volatility of the assumptions. If you're constantly changing based on price earnings, you could have a much higher expected return at one time and much lower at another time, which means if you're doing financial planning based on those numbers, you're like how much you need to save or how much you can spend, that could be relatively volatile.
And we follow the guidelines for inflation. So the plans we've been doing lately are now using the 2.1% inflation rate. We made that change right away.
which actually makes our planning assumptions that we've used, that we are currently using, have a 1.7% implied rate of inflation built into them. Using the 2.1 makes our planning a little bit more conservative. But so I think you kind of mentioned the numbers, but there we go. So with FP Canada's planning assumptions, with a global portfolio excluding Canada, you're expecting a 6.48% return. So that's US, international, and emerging markets.
Just equity, no bonds.
Just equity, 6.48%. And for Canada, FP Canada is saying you should expect 6.1%. So depending on your weight of Canada relative to other stuff, you're 6.3 or something like that for equities. Fixed income FP Canada is using 3.9%. I also looked at our expected returns. So for global ex Canada, we're 6.61% is what we're using. So that's a little bit higher than what FP Canada is using. And for Canada, we're 6.5, which is again, a little bit higher.
And all of our planning is done net of fees.
Yeah. And FP Canada talks about that in their report too, that you've got to take fees into account appropriately.
But so many times people aren't aware of the fees and the fees don't come up in the planning. They use like 8% rate of return and there's no mention of fees. It's like very simplistic. It makes a huge difference over a long period of time.
So you're really talking about 10%.
Yeah. Let alone if you start doing some randomization of the returns, so the Monte Carlo analysis, which we always do.
Yeah, we do Monte Carlo. FP Canada, the way that they approached that was actually interesting. They grossed down their expected return assumptions to account for volatility. So instead of saying, here's the expected return and the standard deviation, go do a Monte Carlo. They reduce the return to account for.
But then you don't have the conversation with the client about how the future values will deviate potentially.
I agree. But for someone who's doing this by themselves at home, then, you know, they're probably not going to have quick access.
So many people will say, I want to make sure I have, if you're starting with $1 million, I want $1 million when I pass away. I just want to live off the income. It's not a reasonable framework to build your future around because you don't know how the returns are going to play out.
Unless you're an income investor, I guess, and you only spend the income. That was kind of a joke. No one's laughing.
All your friends online got it. Okay, you want to go on the worst advice of the week?
Yeah, I think that's good.
Oh, we had a bunch to choose from, but you chose this one.
I thought this one was pretty good. It was a little bit technical, I guess. It wasn't, you know, screamingly bad advice.
I got a kick out of the title of the article, though. ETF industry betting that traditional value strategies need tweaking.
Yeah.
What a loaded article title. It was in Barron's, right?
Yeah. It's called 3 Value ETFs for a New Kind of Value Stock. But they're basically saying that the old way of defining value is no longer any good. Like using book to market, which is what the original value research used, they're saying, yeah, that's no good anymore because, you know, the world's changed. Things are different now. Companies are valued different ways. Companies' balance sheets are different. And so they're suggesting there are ETFs out there that are using different kinds of value metrics in order to access the value premium. And one of the problems with that is that over a given period of time, like book to market, has had a bad decade. So you can go and find value metrics that look better over the last decade, but that's going to be true in any time period.
But that doesn't mean that value has changed all of a sudden.
It doesn't mean the value has changed, and it doesn't mean that those other alternative specifications give you better access to the value premium.
But I wonder how much of this is just the media, I mean, that particular publication having to fill an article.
I mean, I think this is genuinely, like you look at Raffi, which they mention in the article, the fundamental indexing company, and they genuinely believe this. Like this isn't just Barron saying, you know, we need to fill the page. Raffi is their whole pitch is traditional ways of viewing the stock market are wrong. And they use their fundamental indexing strategy, which that's what they do. Raffi uses alternative specifications for stuff like value to find stocks that have been mispriced.
Yep.
So Raffi's whole thing is markets are inefficient, which is kind of what this article is talking about. It's like, okay, maybe markets aren't efficient anymore. So now we've got to use these different value metrics.
It's a whole new world.
So I think that one of the main kind of ties into like what we were talking about with low volatility. If you look at other specifications, like, I don't know, price to cash flow, as opposed to price to book, those alternative specifications will often get you exposure to value because it's still a value metric and something else. So I think it's price. I should have researched this for our episode here, but I think it's price to cash flow. It gives you value and profitability. If you're building a value product with price to cash flow, you're getting value and profitability. So it looks better because you're adding profitability.
Right.
It looks better in the historical data. But now you've kind of muddied up, like, what are you actually investing in? Are you getting value, getting profitability? And are you going to consistently get profitability using that metric?
And if you already have a strategy, why would you want to change it if you've got a good foundation in science strategy? Like, it just seems the whole thing is just driven to get people to make a change. Something's better. Something, you got to bet on this. And that's not healthy to long-term investment success.
I think the way that you can always, well, that you can always, the way that academics will verify something like this is that if you take price to cash flow and look at two different portfolios using factors to explain the differences in returns, if you control for the known factors like size, book to market value, profitability, investment, like all the stuff that we know about, if you control for those factors, does price to cash flow add any additional information? And in that case, the answer is no. But that can always be at least one of the tests for, does this new thing that people are saying is going to be good, does it still add value once we control for the known factors? Now, it does get kind of dicey. Like, it gets kind of tricky, because why is the FAMA French five-factor model the one that we should believe is the truth? And no model is the truth. They're models. That's kind of the point. But I guess it kind of becomes a matter of picking a model that you believe in. And how do you do that? I guess robustness and stuff like that. Someone, I was talking to someone about this a while ago, and they were saying, like, using low volatility as the example. If low volatility gives you varying FAMA French factor exposure, that means the FAMA French factor exposure is also giving you varying low volatility exposure. So what if you wanted to target low volatility? You could say that FAMA French...
That's true.
You could say FAMA French is a bad way to target low volatility, as opposed to low volatility is a bad way to target profitability and value. But it all comes back to, what is your fundamental belief? If you believe that markets price assets efficiently, then FAMA French
side.
That's, yeah.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. So is that good?
Yeah, I think that's it for today.
Yeah, next week we have a great interview on cars in the car market.
Yeah, that's a really good episode.
Yeah, it was great. Anyways, have a good week.